Welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We're glad you're with us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We have an interesting, thought-provoking show today here on Main Street. A little bit later, Matt Olien will review his movie pick of the week, and that's Sing Sing. Dave Thompson and I will look back at the week here in North Dakota's news, but we open the show with something interesting, fun to some, very weird to many. There's that great music that the TV show The Bachelor stole from us. My guest is Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He's a Chester Frist Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota, and he joins us periodically about once a month for Philosophical Currents. Jack, they stole our thunder on The Bachelor with taking your great music pick here.
I'm a trendsetter. What can I tell you?
We have a fun and interesting and thought-provoking topic ahead of us today. Jack, we're going to talk about death bots, and maybe perhaps a little better stated, digital immortality. Do we really want to live forever as AI? And as we start our discussion, Jack, I thought I would lay a definition out there about what a death bot might be. And here's my take. A death bot is an AI-powered digital replica of a deceased person created using their voice recordings, text messages, emails, social media posts, and other digital data. And those bots are then designed to simulate, I guess, the personality, speech patterns, and conversational style of the deceased, allowing loved ones or others to interact with that virtual version of the deceased person forever. Jack?
Well, the first thing that I would point out is that this is not living forever. You're dead and your consciousness is gone and you're not experiencing anything because of the AI. This is entirely about the relationship that the living people have with your memory. And so what AI does is simulate who you are, adopts your speech patterns, adopts your mannerisms, adopts your memories, so to speak, and they can have conversations with you and communicate with you or with a copy of you to make them feel better or more connected or to wash themselves in your memory. So anytime anyone advertises this as living forever, that's a misrepresentation because it doesn't affect you in any way. It's all about the people who survive you.
So what ethical concerns do you see out there if, for example, I'm in my later years. Maybe I have onset of dementia, but my wife had passed away and I want to continue conversing with her AI bot. Is that a bad thing, Jack?
Well, I don't know if we can say it's bad or good in any blanket fashion. I think that it's complex. Obviously, there are privacy issues for the person who has passed away. If you feed the AI their letters, their emails, their diary, all of that sort of stuff, then something that was private becomes public. And people's reputations are at stake and people's memory are at stake. And so you have to be careful about what you're taking from the deceased and whether or not they would want that. Additionally, in an instance of dementia in particular, if you as the person engaging with the AI bot can't tell the difference between who they are and who they're supposed to be, between the fact that it's an AI and a real person, then that can be very confusing. It can be very overwhelming. It can interfere with grief. And so one of the things that it does is mess with people's sense of reality and mess with their agency. They don't get to fully have closure in the loss. And that can be harmful in the long term.
You talk about consent. Something like this can move forward, and I anticipate fully that it will. What, should I deal with this in my will, saying that I authorize no one to use my name, image, and likeness, so to speak, in this context?
Oh, absolutely. We are in a brave new world, and AI is introducing all sorts of things that we couldn't imagine 20 years ago. And that includes reproducing images. The Hollywood strike from last year or 2 years ago, however long it was very much about this, was about the use of AI and creativity and the likenesses that that stars have copyrighted. If you are Taylor Swift or whomever, someone can make millions and millions of dollars off of your image. And so you want to make sure that your kids or your survivors have that copyright power. So absolutely, this is something that we have to anticipate. We have to put it in our wills. We have to communicate with our loved ones in advance. Our digital lives live on so much past what we've ever expected, even just a Facebook account. I have a handful of friends who've passed away, and their Facebook accounts are still online. And on the anniversary of their death, people post messages and things like that. But imagine if someone got a hold of that or was able to infiltrate. They could imitate, they could pretend, they could really mess with people's lives, and they could mess with people's well-beings. And so we have to start thinking about our digital shadow the way we start thinking about everything else.
Jack, as you consider this topic, are there positive uses that come to mind? We call them death bots, which sounds so evil to me, or at least I have called them death bots. But are there any positive from this that can help people, maybe help them with the grieving process? Or would that, again, be so confusing and overwhelming? Is there a role for these that can be positive for humanity?
I think there's a lot of positivity that comes out of it. I know that they're very popular right now in China, and that's where the vast majority of innovation is coming from in terms of the death bots. But I've lost people that I've wanted to talk to. I've lost people that I've talked to, you know, just meditatively myself as I'm walking down the street, or I've written letters to, or things like that. And what the AI does is help you relive that experience. You can find this, for some people, this can be a very healing experience. It can be cathartic. It can give you a sense of intimacy. It can allow you to remember the good times. And hearing someone's voice who's passed away can be very moving and very soothing. This really depends on the person. Again, I'm reluctant to make any blanket statements, because for some people, this could be a very healthy way of going down memory lane. And for talking to somebody and asking their advice and going through their day as if it were a diary, as if they were reflecting on their own thoughts. The important thing to remember is that it is an AI and that it is a pretend. And so as long as the user knows the difference between fiction and reality and knows the difference between who they are and who the AI is, then it has the potential to be very healthy.
Jack, from a philosopher's standpoint, what does the creation of this, or the idea to create these AI replicas of us, say about our relationship with first life, right? There's no reason why we couldn't create this before we die, but then maybe about death and memory, like you've kind of touched on.
Well, first of all, the great philosophical question is, what is consciousness? We don't know what consciousness is. We don't know if our brain is creating this artificial us that is equivalent to an AI. You've seen a lot of science fiction films where they download people's brains. We don't know if that's possible, and we don't know what it means to be us. And so when we have a replica of us, it's very hard to distinguish between the real person communicating and the robot replicating the voice. We also, as human beings, struggle with the idea of death, and we struggle it in two very important ways. First, as people who are mortal, we don't know what's going to happen, and we're very insecure, and we're scared of it in most instances. And that's one of great life's mysteries. But we also struggle with the permanence of other people's death. You know, when someone dies, the first day that it happens is horrible and traumatic. But the second and the third and the fourth, those are worse, because that's when you really have to deal with the consequences of the permanence. And you have to deal with the fact that this person isn't coming back. There's no turning back the clock. There's no ghosts, as far as we know. And they're just gone. And that vast emptiness, that vast insecurity, that vast coldness and loneliness is one of the things that make human beings different from other animals. And so what the AI bot tries to do is fill that hole. What the AI bot tries to do is take away the feeling of permanence and that coldness and that loneliness, to give someone the sense that you're still around. So this is both about fear and about comfort. It's about preserving the memory of someone, but also of trying to be in the world and trying to have a sense of normalcy and retain the past in a way that we absolutely couldn't do in any form until this happened.
We're enjoying our monthly Philosophical Currents conversation with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He's a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy and Director of the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life at the University of North Dakota. And Jack, you, more so than most all of us, have a digital footprint out there. You host this, or you visit with me monthly, and my predecessor, Ashley, in Philosophical Currents. All that digital likeness, I guess, of your voice exists. You also host a monthly radio show right here on Prairie Public. It's called Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Does this at all, this concept of now being able to have Jack maybe not live, but be an AI version of himself for a long time, does this at all alter anything that you would do in your normal life today, recognizing that whatever you do, Jack, may be used against you here, I guess is the way I would describe it?
That's a really interesting question, because I have already contemplated the idea of what do we do with all this stuff once we stop broadcasting? Do I leave money in my will to make sure that it stays on the web? Do I want this to be retained as an archive for as long as possible? And I probably do. So I would like my work to stand, and I would like in 20 years and 30 years and 40 years, people to be able to find these interviews that I've done with you and with the great philosophers so that they can study them and so they can listen to what the great questions were in 2025 and 2015, as opposed to it just disappearing into the ether. The idea that someone could take all of that and make a artificial Jack who might interview people, that's a little bizarre. And I don't know. That makes me feel
it's very weird.
I don't like the idea of things being attributed to me that I didn't do. It's hard enough to be held accountable for the things that I did do, right? But to be held accountable for things that I didn't say, or I didn't, questions I didn't ask, or approaches I didn't make, that's pretty scary. And I think that I wouldn't feel comfortable with the AI Jack out there continuing Y Radio after I was gone. Because I don't think people can tell the difference between an AI you and a real you. And I think that part of what makes the conversations interesting to listeners is how my brain works and how I connect A through B and the questions that you ask and the way that I think about answering. And AI doesn't do that. AI doesn't think. This is really important, and this is what people don't understand. As of right now and for the immediate future, artificial intelligence is not intelligence. It isn't a thinking machine. What they use is language models where they calculate what the next likely word is in the list of all possible words. And they do, I don't know exactly how it works, and the technical stuff is beyond me, but basically they'll have a word and then they'll look at the statistics for what the likeliest word is to follow, and they'll put that in. And this is not thinking. This is not contemplation. This is not consciousness at any level. This isn't even reasoning. What it is a math trick that is wrong as often as it is right. And these AI results that we get at the top of Google searches, for example, they look like they're right, but they're often not. I've had students who've used ChatGPT for papers, and ChatGPT will make up citations. They'll just talk about articles that don't exist and authors that don't exist, and it's one of the ways that you catch students cheating. So the AI Jack wouldn't be a thinking creature. It wouldn't be a reasoning, rational, conscious entity. It would be a math trick. And so it wouldn't even be able to capture the spirit of Jack. And so I wouldn't feel comfortable someone using that voice and confusing listeners about the difference between who I am and who the AI is.
Here's something else that I've contemplated. I touched on it a moment ago, was saying, well, hey, look, this could happen in your real life, not just after you die. And I recall an article that I've read in the New York Times about a Facebook experience. I have never used, I'll state now, Meta's virtual reality glasses. But apparently you can immerse yourself, as this New York Times reporter did over a week, into these AI worlds and be visiting then with these AI-generated replicas of maybe Jack Weinstein or maybe Craig Blumenschein today. What guardrails should we worry about, and how can we know that's probably not already being done?
Well, one of the things that we see from the behavior of the tech companies is that everything is about profit. And so one of the dangers, and this isn't a direct answer to your question, but one of the dangers with these AI robots is what happens if the company decides to put advertising in it. And so my daughter has a conversation with Dead Jack, and Dead Jack says, "Boy, I feel like having a Pepsi Cola, and wouldn't it be great to go to Taco Bell?"
I've thought of all of these things exactly, because you never went to Taco Bell. Your daughter knows that, but now here you are.
That's right. And so we have to remember that all of these things that they're doing are not for the good of humanity. They're for the profit margin. And when Facebook creates images of people, they're doing it to make money and to exploit the people. And so we absolutely need guardrails for, like, copywriting your own image. We should be born with a copyright of our own image. People should be required to give permission before they use voices and images and technology for commercial purposes. And also, which Jack are they going to use? Are they going to use the Jack when I was 30? Are they going to use the Jack when I was 50? Does my daughter get to decide how old she wants her father to be when she communicates? Can she change the image? And what if it's a point in my life when I was suffering? Or what if it's a point in my life when I wasn't happy? I want my daughter to be happy, and I want her to have a lifelong relationship with my memory. But the longer she holds on to the past, and the more she relies on the artificial nature of what they've made me, the more she's subject to the manipulations of other people, the more agency she loses. And so we have to regulate these AI images, and we have to create ethical rules and legal structures to give everyday people the tools to fight back, because it's getting harder and harder and harder. There's a whole discussion in Europe about the right to be forgotten, which is the idea that you can demand, according to the EU, that Google removes links to certain articles, like if 20 years ago you were arrested for something and you've had a good record ever since. There are ways to request that Google removes links to those things. Ultimately, I think it's impossible, but it's an attempt to recognize this right that you have over your own history and your own story. And so what we need to do is figure out how these AI images and replicas are interfering with our stories and way that we as individuals can fight back. And ultimately, that's going to be a legal battle. Ultimately, that's going to be government regulation and lawyers fighting with lawyers. And of course, the poor people are going to have less access to that. The marginalized people are going to have less access to that. The rich people will be safer, but of course the rich people will also be more famous and more subject to exploitation in that sense.
Wondered a couple things. That number one, is your daughter going to be presented with this nice advertisement in the mail 2 weeks after Jack's gone, or my kids 3 weeks after I'm gone, saying, "For $29.95 a month, you can interact with your father. Just pay now, and we'll, as long as you pay us, we'll give that resource to you." And then secondly, talking about younger people here, do you think they view this differently than we do, Jack, because of the way they've grown up with technology, which is, I'll be the first to admit, very different than the way I grew up and enjoy technology today?
You know, I absolutely think that 2 weeks after I die, she'll get those advertisements. And that's when she's the most vulnerable. And that's when she's going to agree to something that maybe is the worst thing for her. People need grieving time. People need period to be a period of meditation and reflection. And for some people, that's 6 months. For some people, that's 2 years. And it depends how close they are. It depends to their parents, how meaningful they are. Imagine losing a child and the idea of having your child back, and you get this advertisement. You can continue to talk to your child for the next 10 years if you want. I mean, the what you'd be willing to pay in your grief for that as exploitative. So I think that that is very, very scary and very dangerous. I teach a media ethics class, and one of the things that is becoming very clear, it's the first time I'm teaching it, is that in many respects, my students are more sophisticated than the things that we're reading. That kids who've grown up with this technology and grown up with computers understand social networks and understand virtual reality and understand the manipulation in ways that us older folks don't. And so I do think that the younger people are going to have a different relationship with this and that they may be more comfortable with this, but it also means that they don't know anything but this and they don't have an alternative. And if you are raised in an environment where the dead are always with you, you don't know what it's like to lose them, and you don't know which is better for you. And so, like all great technological change, the impact that this has on the next generation is incredibly powerful and unavoidable. And you can't get outside that perspective. My daughter can't not have grown up with computers. They are essential parts of her, and she can't see otherwise, and she might not be able to see the virtue of an analog life, the virtue of journaling, the virtue of sitting in a park bench and talking to my memory without hearing my memory talk back. And those might be really valuable skills to have that we need to cultivate in the new generation so that the analog life and so that the life of loss and limitation is preserved.
Jack, we have just about a minute left, but I wonder, relative to things we should be thinking about today, and this is with policymakers and others, that these tools, if you call them tools, can be used to manipulate agendas. In other words, it almost goes back to the Taco Bell idea that we talked about earlier. If I have an agenda, then I can create Craig Blumenstein's likeness, have him interact with others just like they used to, but then slowly introduce kind of where I want to steer people. That to me is just so scary, but probably real.
Oh, it's very scary and very real. Imagine if the company starts advocating for a particular political candidate, and now the memory of your father or the memory of your spouse or the memory of your of whomever is bringing up this candidate, how good this candidate is and what this candidate is going to do for you. How do you counter that? How do you avoid being influenced by the memory of someone who was so important to
Dad
you?
Dad said, this guy's good. Come on.
Yeah. And if you can't remember that Dad isn't Dad, it makes it even worse.
So much to think about. It's digital immortality has been our topic. Do we really want AI to make us, in air quotes now, live forever as AI? My guest has been Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy and Director of the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life at the University of North Dakota. And of course, he's the great host of the public radio show we air monthly on Prairie Public, Why? Philosophical discussions about everyday life. Jack, it's always a pleasure.
I love it every talk. Thanks so much, Craig.
Like Barry and his voice got bass. A body like Arnold with a Denzel face. He's smart like a doctor with a real good rep. And when he comes home, he's relaxed with pep. He always got a gift for me.
Still to come in the second half of today's show, News Director Dave Thompson and I review North Dakota's Newsweek. Matt Olean reviews the movie Sing Sing, and Dr. Tom Ezern stops by with another of his great plainspoke essays. Stay with us.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Josh Beauchet, broker and realtor with Real Broker LLC. With a team of agents serving homebuyers, sellers, and investors throughout North Dakota, the Detroit Lakes area, and Northwest Minnesota. Josh can be reached at 701-367-3513.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Gather round, everybody. Gonna tell you a story.
Dave Thompson joins us each and every Thursday here on Main Street to review the news in North Dakota. Dave, how are you today?
I'm doing fine, Craig. How are you?
Dave, of course, you're in the middle of the North Dakota legislative session, and I want to begin our segment by asking you, The one big story this week from the legislature is...
The one big story is the idea that they're going to raise the bar to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot. Whether it be from the legislature or by citizen initiative, they said that it should be a 60% vote to amend the Constitution. Right now it's 50% plus one vote. Now they say that one of the reasons they're doing that is because North Dakota has become one of those shopping places where people have ideas and they shop it in North Dakota because it's easy to get it passed. And they want to prevent that in the future.
Where do you think it might head, Dave?
This is the odd part about it. This has to be voted on by the people. What's the threshold for getting this voted on by the people? This one is 50.1 because they haven't adopted the 60% yet.
The easier threshold. Dave, what time is it? And I ask you that question because there's a bill moving through the legislature to keep North Dakotans on standard time, to which I would be in favor of, Dave.
Absolutely, and there's a lot of people in favor of it. They said that they would like either standard time or daylight savings time around so that people can prepare for it. But this bill has been tried a number of times in the past. I think in my first legislative session that I covered, which was 1979, there was a bill to do that, to make it all standard time and not go to daylight savings time. It passed, but apparently at the time the Federal Department of Transportation has something to say about it. There's a hurdle to get over if you pass it.
I think with the new administration in place, Dave, I think this has a chance to catch fire nationwide, if not become a federal law all by itself. Dave, there's a Fargo lawmaker, two of them actually, who have now proposed maybe to study at least the creation of Grand Ranch. Tell us more.
So what it is that you've got Grand Farm, which is talking about production agriculture. You've got Grand Skies, which talks about drones. So Senator Tim Mathern came up with this idea that we need to preserve soil health, that we're losing some of our soil health. So he is suggesting Grand Ranch, where they're looking at ways to monetize having the ranch facilities and saving, you know, the soil. And he said one way you can do that is by using it for carbon dioxide, because that's a good storage area for carbon dioxide. Plus, there's some economic values and there are some health values about keeping our grasslands the way they are.
Dave, a feel-good story as we wrap things up here. North Dakota students are outperforming the national average in math.
It is. It's very good to see, because everybody was kind of kicked back a little bit during the COVID years, where there wasn't one-on-one or you didn't have a teacher actually in a classroom. You had him on a computer or her on a computer. So now they're looking at it, and what has been the effect in North Dakota? We've actually seen better scores after the COVID thing is gone now, and you get people returning to classroom. We're doing very well. And compared to the rest of the nation, we're doing very well as well.
One of the good outcomes from COVID, Dave. Thanks for being with us. We review the news each and every Thursday here on Main Street. Dave, get some rest this weekend and have another great week.
Thank you, Craig.
Dakota Medical Foundation is reminding listeners of Giving Hearts Day, a 24-hour event supporting charities in North Dakota and Northwest Minnesota, Thursday, February 13th. Since 2008, Giving Hearts Day has connected donors with charities to help fund their missions and raise over $195 million. Learn more at givingheartsday.org.
And we're ready in the Main Street studio to welcome back Matt Olean. He's our movie reviewer here at Prairie Public, and specifically for Main Street. Matt, how are you?
I'm good, Craig.
The movie this week is Sing Sing. It's a prison set drama that follows John Whitfield, or Divine G. He's an incarcerated man who maintained steadfast compassion and resilience despite his conviction for a crime he claims he didn't commit. Here's the trailer.
To die, to sleep, to dream.
This is a clemency hearing for your conviction, 25 to life. Since you've been in custody, you've been involved in a theater program.
Gentlemen, let's go.
It's been a program that was established to help people get more in touch with their feelings and truly get some rehabilitation.
I am Gladiator Goliath.
I am Spartacus.
I'm Prince Hamlet of Denmark.
And it's turned into something, wonderful.
What part do you play
From time to time, I do act, like we all do.
So are you acting at all during this interview?
We're here to become human again and enjoy the things that is not in our reality.
I think you guys are becoming real with each other, vulnerable.
Listen, I already know what you're doing, know who you are, what you're about, bro.
What?
You don't get to tell me what I need in prison. You don't get to do that. And don't bring me in no dark corners no more.
The world expects brothers like you and I to walk in with our heads held down. Nah, what you gotta walk in
like a king. Everything is yours.
I'm divine now.
Yeah.
This is my theater.
Now give him some love, give him some love.
Go to your most perfect spot. Do you hear anything? Are you with somebody? Are you outside? Hold that feeling.
Let's go!
You gotta admit that I murdered that Hamlet for me, bro. Shakespeare is in his grave right now. He rolled over.
You did your thing, beloved.
All right, Matt, we've heard the trailer. The story revolves around rehabilitation through the arts, an RTA theater program inside Sing Sing's maximum security prison, where G is a respected member. Matt, this blends realism with fiction. Is it a true story? Is it fiction? What do you have for us about the movie?
It is based on a true story. So it is based on the Sing Sing rehabilitation through the arts program that they do. And the prisoners in this movie, one of the best films of the year, let me just say that, of 2024. And what listeners are seeing, Craig, is the last month and in the upcoming in February, I'll be continuing to knock off these Oscar-nominated films. And Colman Domingo is up for Best Actor as the prisoner who claims he did not commit the crime. This is his second straight Best Actor nomination. He was nominated last year for a film called Rustin. He's a wonderful actor. And he's really the kind of the organizer of this theater arts program. Paul Racy from Sound of Metal fame is kind of also the director. He helps the prisoners put on the play. But yes, it's based on the Sing Sing program that really has done an amazing job with these prisoners. And Colman Domingo and Paul Racy are the only two professional actors in this movie. Everyone else is kind of a non-professional, former prisoners, actors. Clarence Macklin has a really key role. He's a former prisoner as well, kind of plays a version of himself. I thought he might get a supporting actor Oscar nomination. He's really good as kind of a new prisoner who kind of butts heads with Colman Domingo's character. And he's more out there showing his toughness in the prison yard, that kind of a prisoner. And so they have to work through their differences to put on this play, whether it's going to be Hamlet or some comedy, and the prisoners want to put on a comedy. So it is based on a true story in Sing Sing. I think that's what makes it powerful. I think the other thing that makes it powerful from director Craig Quidar is he doesn't succumb to the typical tropes, the typical problems that happen with feel-good movies. You know, there's a lot of movies like this, Craig, where there's a group of people and they're rehabilitated, or they're it's the classroom film where the teacher inspires them, or people are rehabilitated. And a lot of times directors fall into the trap of trying to tell us how to feel with emotional music and all those beats where you're supposed to feel good. And it doesn't do that. So it's a feel-good movie. It's a social commentary movie without hammering the viewer over the head with the message, if you see what I'm driving at. It's very subtle. It's not a very long film. People are going to enjoy this. So it's a really interesting thread that they weave here. It's a social commentary film. It's also a feel-good film, but the public's going to like it. It's not overly artsy, where some mainstream audiences don't like that. And so I think it's a real amazing that he succeeded in this way. And it's, of course, based on the true story, which makes it all the more interesting. So I really like this movie. Colman Domingo is a tremendous actor. He is one of the most in-demand actors out there right now. As I said, Paul Racy's really good, and Clarence Macklin, and all the prisoners who are non-professional actors. Sometimes that works. We saw this years ago in those Italian neorealist films after World War II, where directors like Vittorio De Sica would use non-professional actors to make the film seem more realistic. But what the director pulls off is when Colman Domingo has scenes with prisoners that are played by non-professional actors, even though Domingo's a professional actor, it's all seamless. It doesn't seem like he's acting with non-professional actors, and it doesn't seem like he's overacting, like he's not overdoing the theatricality of his performance just because he's trained. You see what I'm driving at? And that's a real interesting thing that the director pulls off, and it makes the film.
There's a little bit of humor in here through the play Breaking the Mummy's Code. Did that make the movie more normal, I guess?
Yeah, they do put on a comedy in the movie without giving too much away, and the Colman Domingo character is reluctant to have them put a comedy on. He wants something more serious. There's scenes where he recites Hamlet. There's a scene where Clarence Macklin recites from Hamlet. Very interesting how they kind of recite Hamlet, maybe not in the way that we're used to, you know? But yes, it is funny in parts. It's tragic in parts. There are scenes that I really liked where Colman Domingo goes in front of the parole board. You know, he wants out. He loves the theater arts program, but he wants out, okay? And so those parole hearings are really interesting when they come because you can see the nervousness in Colman Domingo's character. You're in front of three or four people. You're trying to tell them you didn't do the crime, you want out, all this kind of thing. You're rehabilitated, and they're peppering him with questions. So I like that part as well. So it has a nice mixture of comedy, some tragedy, and some social drama. Certainly one of my top 10 films of the year, for sure.
All right, Matt, before we get into our Oscar trivia part of the program, you're bringing a director's chair film series, Women in the Director's Chair. It starts Saturday at the Maine Fargo Public Library. Tell us a little more about that, Matt.
So about three times a year in the winter, I do a film series with Lori West at the Fargo Public Library. Lori and I curate these. And it's usually November, February, and April. In November, we had disaster movies of the 1970s, which, you know, that was the decade of disaster movies. You remember, Craig. Women in the Director's Chair. So this will be a fun series, and they are on Saturdays. I want to let my usual suspects, people that come to these series, know that the Fargo Downtown Library is no longer open on Sundays in 2025. We used to have the series on Sundays at 2 p.m., now it'll be Saturdays at 2 p.m. So February 1st, 8th, 15th, and the 22nd are our four movies. And I do a Q&A at the end. So our first film is The Hitchhiker, directed by Ida Lupino, 1953. She was literally the only woman director working in the 40s and 50s. It was a man's job. It just was back then. But since then, of course, it's opened up to women. And then the rest of our films are more modern movies. Jane Campion's The Piano, Deborah Granick's Winter's Bone, and Catherine Bigelow's Zero Dark Thirty. So now it's more normal. Like with my job at the Fargo Film Festival, half of the movies we get in are directed by women. And that was not the case, you know, 50, 60 years ago. So a big change in the film industry, opening those doors for women. And we're going to highlight those in four straight Saturdays at 2 p.m. in February.
And they're free to attend at the Fargo Public Library. Mm-hmm. The address there is 101 4th Street North, downtown here in Fargo. Matt, what do you have coming ahead for us?
So again, we'll keep moving through these really good films of 2024 because right now, you know, 2025, the films being released are like Flight Risk or bad. And are not going to be up for Oscars. So next week, we'll talk about The Room Next Door, the new film by Pedro Almodovar. And then I will review The Substance with Demi Moore. I missed that last summer, and now it's up for a lot of Oscars. I'm going to watch The Apprentice, which was Sebastian Stan's Best Actor nomination as Donald Trump. And I will see the new Captain America movie with Anthony Mackie. So we'll slip a new one in with all the 2024 Oscar-type movies in the next month.
All right, Matt, let's get to the Oscar component of our show. Give me the most nominated prison movie of all time.
Shawshank Redemption.
That's right, Matt. Do you have an idea of how many awards it was nominated for? And not to steal anything, it didn't win any of them.
It didn't win. It was up for Best Picture in 94, lost to Forrest Gump. Morgan Freeman, I think, should have won the Oscar for Best Actor. He lost to Tom Hanks and Forrest Gump. Oh, I think the cinematography might have been
nominated. That's correct,
yeah. Maybe adapted screenplay. Yep. It's based on a Stephen King short story. How many more am I missing?
Three.
Sound?
Yep.
Editing?
Yep. One more to go, Matt. To me, it's almost like sound, but score?
Music score.
That's it.
Oh, I got them all.
Okay. You did, Matt. Congratulations. And it doesn't surprise me a bit that Matt Olean, our movie reviewer here at Prairie Public and Oscar trivia extraordinaire guy, got those today. Matt, thanks for joining us again on Main Street.
You bet.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Dr. Tom Ezern is with us with another Plains Folk essay. He'll delve into the fascinating story of Myra Hull, a Kansas ballad collector who recorded her unique rendition of Whoopee Thai-I-O. Get along, little doggies, for Alan Lomax at the Library of Congress, uncovering the rich history and haunting beauty of cowboy songs on the Great Plains.
On the 17th of July, 1939, Alan Lomax of the American Folklife Center, Library of Congress, wrote to Myra E. Hull, the mild-mannered ballad collector from Kansas. My dear Miss Hull, I just received the issue of the Publications of the Kansas Historical Society and read your article on cowboy songs with great interest. It is a real contribution to original studies in the field. The two correspondents were acquainted, in a general way, in that Lomax surely knew something of Louise Pound in Nebraska, Franz Rickaby in North Dakota, and other prairie songcatchers who labored far from eastern seats of learning. But also in a more specific way, in that 2 years earlier, Myra, while on a research visit to the library, had sung her repertoire of Great Plains folk song into Allen's reel-to-reel recorder for the library's collections. There to rest, until I came to the Folklife Center, received friendly greetings and professional assistance from the archival staff, and put on the earphones. Then the magic commenced. I had read Myra's writings and researched her prairie girlhood, her modest academic career, and her spinsterly life with her mother, an intriguing veneer for a secret life as a connoisseur of cowboy balladry. Her voice, though, provided a far more fascinating entry into her life and songs, which she gathered from her family and neighbors. I arrived at the library, especially interested in one of the cowboy ballads Myra had written up for the Kansas Historical Quarterly issue she had mailed to Alan Lomax. It's a well-known folk song. Whoopee-tai-yi-yo, get along, little dogies, sung throughout the cattle country of the Great Plains. The earliest known text was reported by Owen Wister in Texas in 1893. As I was a-walkin' one mornin' for pleasure, I saw a cowpuncher ridin' along. His hat was throwed back, and his spurs was a-jinglin', and as he approached, he was a-singin' this song. Myra's version, however, is like no other. Like the ballad I talked about in another essay, Night Herding Song, she got Get Along Little Doggies from a relative, Dr. Hull Alden Cook, a physician well-traveled in cow country and later author of the memoir 50 Years a Country Doctor. Dr. Cook and Myra impart a wonderfully bluesy flair to the traditional cowboy chorus. Whoopee-tai-yi-yo, get along, little doggie, that's your misfortune and none of my own. Whoopee-tai-yi-yo, get along, little doggie, you know that Wyoming will be your new home. And then, most remarkable, a second chorus, deliciously and devilishly basso. Whoopee-tai-yi-yo, get along, little doggies, it's your misfortune and none of my own. Whoopee-tai-yi-yo, get along, little doggies, you know that Wyoming will be your new home. Myra seems off her game singing this ballad. Was it just a little too devilish for her? Or perhaps it was a case of nerves.
To record, Lomax took her not into a secluded studio, but into the library's impressive Coolidge Auditorium. A kind archivist got me into the room. Suppose Get Along Little Doggies were the first ballad she recorded. That stage would have been daunting. Myra was not in Kansas anymore, but she sang her songs.
That's Dr. Tom Ezern with another of his Plains Folk Essays. Dr. Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University.
Support for PrePublic is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Daybook for January 30th. January is a crucial month for gardeners. By the end of the month, seed catalogs are dog-eared, orders are penciled in, and colorful dreams and schemes begin to solidify. So it was on this date in 1932 when a group of North Dakota and Manitoba gardeners and dreamers went public with plans for a new garden in the Turtle Mountains that would span the 49th parallel between Dunseith, North Dakota, and Boisevain, Manitoba. Not a vegetable garden, mind you, but a 3,000-acre plot containing hills and trees and lakes to be dedicated as a natural monument to peace. The sponsors announced that the site would be known as the International Peace Garden, free of commercialism, with half of the land in the United States and half in Canada. They said it would be a shrine to peace. The idea grew out of annual peace picnics that had been taking place in the shady recesses of the Turtle Mountains for several years. The picnics celebrated the long history of peaceful relations between the U.S. and Canada. It was out of these peace picnics, which were attended by as many as 5,000 people, that the dream of a permanent peace garden was born. The founders envisioned a natural landscape complemented by the work of leading gardeners and landscape artists of both nations. Their vision excluded any commercial development. They were seeking legislation that would disallow any gasoline stations, roadhouses, dance pavilions, or other resorts within 5 miles of the park, providing a protected zone. No small thinkers, they asked for $5 million right in the middle of America's Great Depression, over $70 million in today's dollars. One-fifth of that would be used for direct improvements of the park, and four-fifths would be set aside as a permanent endowment to assure proper maintenance down through the years. The organizers sought support from service clubs, the state and provincial governments, individual donors, and even the nickels and dimes of American and Canadian school children. Perhaps the financial bleakness of the 1930s and the fear of another war had helped inspire the Peace Garden planners, but in July of 1932, 50,000 individuals traveled from all over the United States and Canada to witness the groundbreaking and dedication ceremony for this unique and enduring garden in the center of North America, the International Peace Garden. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Russell Ford Dunker. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
The transportation secretary promises not to pass the buck after a mid-air collision outside Washington. What the investigation is finding on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for this Thursday edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us today. Tomorrow in this time slot at 3 p.m. Central, it's The Middle with host Jeremy Hobson. This week's topic, your questions on the Middle East, answered with the former president of Iraq, Barham Salih. And at 7 p.m. Central, it's Science Friday with Ira Flato. From all of us here at Prairie Public, we hope you have a great North Dakota weekend, and we will look forward to seeing you again Monday on Main Street.